Welcome to The Dinner Party. This is your icebreaker.
This joke came from a 16-year-old girl on Twitter. Why did the hipster burn his mouth on the pizza? Because he ate it before it was cool.
I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and from APM American Public Media, this is The Dinner Party, the culture show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations.
You just got a joke from novelist Emma Straub. That'll help break the ice. Emma's new book, Laura Lamont's Life in Pictures, comes out next week. We'll hear her read from it later. Also, we'll speak with Marjan Satrapi. She made the Oscar-nominated movie Persepolis and the new film, Chicken with Plums.
Plus, author and satirist Fran Lebowitz has no problem telling you how to behave.
None.
And V. Neal, Oscar-winning makeup artist, lists some of her favorite makeup moments.
Yeah. Is that why you're painted like a clown today?
Nope.
Okay. But first, as at any dinner party, we start with small talk. All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
Isaac is still a big threat to Louisiana and Mississippi.
Tributes are pouring in for astronaut Neil Armstrong, who died this weekend at age 82.
Republican National Convention in session and called to order.
Now for a story you might not have heard. We are speaking with Richard Lawson. He is senior writer at the Atlantic Wire. Richard, what story are you going to be talking about at parties this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about a tourist in Iceland who went in search of herself, quite literally.
Not literally, like Eat, Pray, Love?
No, literally, yes.
Tell us more.
There was no food. Well, there was a woman who was on a tour bus in Iceland touring volcanoes and canyons and things like that. And she left the bus, went for a walk, and when she came back, the bus didn't leave because there was a woman that didn't get back on the bus. And so they waited there for an hour and she didn't show up.
Okay.
There was a search called. The police were involved. And after about a day of searching, she found out that it was her.
The supposedly missing person was actually this woman who had gotten back on the bus in the first place?
Yes. And the best thing about the story is that she was participating in her own search.
How did they not know that she had gotten back on the bus?
Well, apparently when she was on her walk around the volcanic canyon, she had just changed her clothes. Like, I don't know if she took off a sweater or something, but when she got back on, the guy who was doing the count didn't recognize her. I mean, he had the description. He said, I'm looking for a woman who's about 5'2". She's of Asian descent. She's 20s or 30s. And that woman obviously fit the bill, but she didn't kind of put two and two together and then finally said, oh, I think you're looking for me.
What did she change into? Like, what, you're touring a volcano?
Did
like
she go into an invisibility suit?
She's a shapeshifter, so that partially explains
it. Yeah, she put on a bear outfit and came back in. Or I'm just trying to think of the moment she was like, uh-oh.
Right.
I wonder if there was an extra 4 hours they didn't find her because she was just so embarrassed about having to finally...
Yeah, admit it.
Oh, I'm sure. It's like, you know, looking for your glasses and they're on your head the whole time.
They finally figured it out when she looked at a milk carton and it was of her.
Right, exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
There I am.
And this is the kind of thing that really, I think, only happens in Iceland. I mean, you know, when Bjork invents a country, it just... weird things are going to happen.
It's a confounding place. Richard Lawson... thanks for the small talk.
Thanks, guys.
And now time for cocktails.
This is the part of the show where we tell you something that happened in history, then give you a fitting drink to serve along with it.
It's our sweet yet palatable history lesson with booze.
First, the history. This coming week, back in 1698, Russian Tsar Peter the Great enacted one of the oddest taxes ever.
We doubt your dinner guests will know what it was. Thanks to our friend Michelle Philippi, you're about to.
Peter the Great tried to change the face of Russia. Literally. It all began when Peter took a tour of Europe. In Holland, he learned shipbuilding. In Germany, he learned to wipe his lips with a dinner napkin. Peter fell in love with Western culture. Surely, this was the way of the future. So when he got back home, Peter greeted his noblemen with a Western-style hug, then whipped out a razor and cut off their beards. Western men were clean-shaven, he said. Russians should be too. Problem was, Russians really dug their beards. Aristocrats and the devoutly religious grew them down to their chests. So to get everyone on board, Peter imposed a beard tax. You could keep your whiskers if you paid the state 100 rubles. And once you paid, you had to carry around state-issued proof. A coin stamped with a little picture of a bearded face. Peter posted guards at city gates to make sure the unshaven andied up. The tax never brought in much cash, and when Peter died, the tax went with him. But the war on beards continued elsewhere. Margaret Thatcher made every member of her cabinet shave. And Walt Disney outlawed beards for Disneyland workers, a ban that was only lifted this year. Animatronic Abe Lincoln is said to be pleased.
So that was the history. Now for the drink to serve with it. On the line is Ken Biberai of the famed Russian Tea Room in New York City. Ken, you heard the story. What drink does it inspire you to make?
A Rasputin. Obviously inspired by Rasputin himself and his beard.
Oh, that's right. Rasputin had an enormous beard. Apparently, he was not affected by the tax.
No. And it's made with the most popular liquor that we have here, which is obviously vodka.
So how do you make this thing? Take me through it step by step.
Well, you got some Frangelico. Gives you a little hypnotic scent.
And also Frangelico, supposedly made by a monk. Rasputin, the mad monk of Russia.
You see that? You're making all kinds of connections, Rico.
I'm telling you, buddy.
You're hired. Come on down.
Great.
And then you have it with Tsar's Gold vodka that you mix it with.
Tsar's Gold, of course. What? How much of that?
We usually do, not a 50-50, but the Tsar's Gold would be about a third. You definitely put a little bit more of the Frangelico. It's a really nice, like, nutty concoction. You know, it gives you a nice rustic and outdoors feel.
All right. So vodka, Frangelico, and that's it?
Yeah, that on the rocks, you shake it up.
Nice. Actually, I wanted to ask, the Russian Tea Room's been around on and off for like 80 years. Does this drink go back that far?
Yeah, we actually found this drink on one of the menus from the 1940s. There are a couple that have really been on the Russian Tea Room menu for a while, including the Moscow Mule, which is another great one. We also have an Ivan the Terrible. That is actually pretty it's pretty rough.
It sounds pretty terrible.
Green chartreuse and the Bacardi rum.
Be honest with me. Do actual Russians come in and order something like, a Moscow Mule, or are they just looking for a nice, good shot of vodka?
A lot of them will look for a good shot of vodka.
So, Rico, I've been spending a lot of time in Brooklyn lately.
All right.
And I am telling you, if they brought back the beard tax there, with the revenues, you could, build a new city hall made of solid gold.
There's a lot of bewhiskered bohemians roaming around there.
There are a lot of Rasputins, yes.
Scary. People, you can find every cocktail recipe we've ever had on the show at our website, dinnerpartydownload.org. It is tax-free.
And now, the guest list, in which an interesting person lists some interesting things.
And this week, our guest is V. Neal. She's one of the most acclaimed makeup artists in Hollywood and also a judge on Sci-Fi's reality show about special effects makeup. She stopped by to list her favorite work by others in her field.
Hi, my name is V. Neal, and I am one of the judges on the TV show Face Off on Sci-Fi. You may have seen some of my work. I've won Oscars for Beetlejuice, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Ed Wood. So here's a list of my three favorite makeups in movies. The first one would be The Bride of Frankenstein, where Elsa Lankester, of course, is the Bride of Frankenstein, done by the great Jack Pierce, makeup artist, who designed all of the original Universal monsters, starting with Frankenstein, the Mummy, Wolfman. There's a great scene where she meets the Frankenstein monster for the first time, and she looks absolutely amazing. Her hair is like straight back in a huge shock. She's got white streaks on either side, and she gets introduced to the Frankenstein monster, and she turns to him and hisses, and it's just almost like a release of like electricity coming out of her mouth from when she has been shocked and brought to life. And it's probably one of my favorite scenes in a film, with those two meeting in black and white. And it's just an amazing, makeup transformation for not only her, but him as well, obviously. My second one would be Star Wars, the Cantina sequence, which has so many fantastic characters in it. Stuart Freeborn, Rick Baker, several other makeup artists who were not even credited on the film, transformed humans into these very far-fetched aliens that we see in the Star Wars Cantina sequence, which is probably one of the funnest things, that's ever been done. There's a character that looks like a big fake fur snowball. And at one point or another, you'll see Rick Baker actually pop up in a makeup that looks sort of like a devil character, which is kind of cool. And they do look, they're very, fake fur looking guys. It is really remedial now, but it was fun. You've got Chewbacca, who was fabulous. He didn't have fake fur. He had actual hair. It was in a whole big ventilated suit. So that was very state of the art at the time. And I mean, that still kind of holds up. Now they'd probably CGI his mouth and do all kinds of crazy stuff. But I mean, all in all, he was a pretty fantastic character. At the time, it was the most exciting makeup transformations that we had seen. I was just pretty much starting out, but to think that you could actually do that to a human being was awesome. Last but not least would be The Exorcist, which is probably one of my all-time favorite makeups, which scared the heck out of me when I was little. You know, it still is quite frightening. Dick Smith, who's the god of makeup, as we all know, or most of us do anyway, created that, and he did the Godfather films, Taxi Driver, Stepford Wives. I mean, the man is just, you know, he's beyond the beyond. The Exorcist is about a film about a young girl who's possessed by a demon, the devil, what have you. And her makeup is truly frightening. She has sores all over her face. She's got teeth. She's got contact lenses. She has horrible eruptions all over her body. Her head twists around backwards, which is one of the scariest things I've ever seen. She also walks downstairs backwards. When I saw it, it was frightening. I mean, it was so realistic. I mean, I don't think I'd ever really seen anything that looked that real. I mean, Linda Blair was truly frightening. And in that film, you do see a complete transformation of what she looked like when she was a child into this horrible demon creature. I think probably the film that I'm most proud of would be the transformation of Robin Williams into Mrs. Doubtfire. For those of you who haven't seen Mrs. Yeah. Doubtfire, it is a man passing himself off as an old woman. Robin wore 13 overlapping foam latex appliances, as well as a fat suit, as well as a wig. And the first time we did it, it took about 4 hours to get him into makeup, and eventually I got it down to 2 hours with an assistant. And sometimes we did it even faster, which was amazing, probably on a day when we weren't exhausted. Robin, when he first looked at himself in the mirror, absolutely loved it. And it was really fun for him because we were shooting on the streets in San Francisco. And I remember standing next to him on a corner and somebody walked up to me and they said, "Hey, I heard Robin Williams is here today. Is he here?" And I'm looking around, I'm looking at Robin, and I said, "Yeah, he's somewhere. He's somewhere around here." And Robin just chuckled because nobody knew he was anything but an old lady.
The guest list from V. Neal. You can catch her Tuesday nights on the Sci-Fi Channel's special effects makeup show, Face Off. Its new season just began.
And Brendan, I have to say, the cantina scene from Star Wars.
Yeah.
Brought joy to my heart to hear about that. That had such an impact on me.
Yeah.
Most of those characters never appear again, but I could probably name them all.
Wow,
actually.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, there's Greedo. There's Ponda Baba is one of
that's
them.
That's really interesting, right?
Dr. Evazan is the guy with the nose. Hammerhead, a.k.a. Momon Nadon,
that's really
of course.
Neat. Speaking of movies to get excited about, coming up, Marjan Satrapi, the artist and filmmaker behind Persepolis, will be here to talk about her latest project and her dream job.
I would have loved to work in a circus and throw knives.
Don't move till the dinner party continues.
Snaggletooth.
Welcome back to The Dinner Party, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party. I am Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. Later, satirist Fran Lebowitz demonstrates why she is the last person you should ask about proper dinner party etiquette.
The worst thing you can have in your house is other people.
But we ask her anyway.
Of course.
Yeah.
Also coming up, author Emma Straub reads from her new novel, Lara Lamont's Life in Pictures. But first, it's time to meet our guest of honor.
And this week it's author, illustrator, and filmmaker Marjan Satrapi. In the early 2000s, she published the acclaimed graphic novel Persepolis about her life growing up in and eventually leaving Iran. The movie version was nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Oscars. She has now co-written and co-directed the new live-action film Chicken with Plums, based on her novel. It opens in L.A. this week. The other day, I spoke with her about it. And Marjan, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
This story is basically about a kind of self-obsessed Iranian violinist in the 1950s and the love of his life. But the tone and the look of the film are really just a collage of different styles and of different moods. It's from very broad comedy to sad melodrama. I'm curious to know how you describe the story to people when they ask.
This is actually a story that has a couple of different layers. You have a first layer that happens in the 50s. In the 50s, you know, a coup d'etat happened in my country that destroyed the whole dream of democracy. Mm. You know, the name of the lover is Iran.
Yeah, the name of the Iranian violinist's love, true love, is Iran.
Absolutely. So, you know, of course, it's an allegory between that and this love that I have for my country that I have left that I cannot go back. Mm. Then you have a very realistic story about a man. His instrument is broken, and since he cannot replace his music instrument, he tries to lie down and die. And then he dies 8 days after.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. You give away within the first 20 minutes of the film what the ending is going to be, which is this protagonist is going to die.
Absolutely.
Clearly, this movie is a lot about fate. You know what the ending is. There's just the matter of how you get there. What fascinates you about that?
Well, I'm fascinated by death because I think it's a complete scandal that I have to die. You know, like now I'm like 41. I know my life much better than when I was 20. And certainly when I will be 60, I will know even better.
And ironically, at some point thereafter, you'll die.
Absolutely. I mean, when finally I will understand what is really going on, I have to die. I mean, how not to be obsessed by the idea of death? And the reason also, you know, I killed the main character at the beginning is that we'll be all going to die. So it's not a surprise that he dies. Mm. Like, since we know that he's going to die, let's celebrate his life.
So you kind of get the inevitable death part out of the way early.
Like that is done, we know, and then we can talk about something else.
And you do talk about lots of things. There are tons of stories within stories in this film. You like following secondary characters all the way to the end of their lives sometimes. Mm-hmm. You kind of very quickly give little biographies of them. First of all, why do it that way? Why have all these stories within stories?
Because that is what I like in life, you know. I love to listen to people's story. And the more, you know, it has different branches and the more it goes in different direction, that is the thing that I like the most. I don't like one story from A to B, you know, and you know, more or less you expect what you're going to see and you expect what is going to happen. Then you don't have a good story at the end.
It is really fun watching how you treat each of those stories. Some of them are animated. Some of these little secondary storylines are presented like there's one that's kind of like a Dayglo American sitcom.
Yes.
Which one of those was the most fun for you to put together?
Well, that was the American sitcom. I was laughing so much myself that I could even not say cut. You know, because I was watching so much, you know, Who's the Boss? You know this thing?
When you were growing up?
Yeah. It's really, you know, like a sitcom and is really not good. But these are the things that I also like. And, you know, I have not made any film school, so I don't know really what is vulgar and bad taste. But I'm not scared of bad taste. I like these things a lot. These are things that really makes me laugh.
You kind of reveled in the banality of the American sitcom. I wonder, though, your first film was animated. This one still feels very composed visually. It's shot mainly on sets. There is a lot of artifice. Mm-hmm. Would you ever consider doing a more realistic, kind of gritty film?
You know, the reality does not interest me so much. You know, I'm a little bit, I like the things that are a little bit glamorous and beautiful. I love when the light is very beautiful. Mm. I like it when it's elegant. So I don't think I will be very attracted by that. No, actually.
Why is that, do you think? I mean, you're doing fine without making a film like that, but I do wonder what attracts you to the glamour and the artificial nature of the way you're making films.
Just the beauty. I think that the beauty makes people better. I think, you know, to be able to offer a 1.5 hour of dream is better than offering 1.5 hour of murder, for example. Well, still, you have some murder that is really cool, like, you know, like the film Machete of Rodriguez, you know, this kind of film, I love them. Yeah, Machete is a beautiful murder, you know, like Pulp Fiction is beautiful murders. This kind of thing I can do.
All right.
Yeah.
I feel turning a little bit more to something very real, namely Iran and the way that it's perceived by people.
Yes.
Westerners, me included, actually, typically hear very little about Iran, except that we're supposed to fear it.
Yes.
What about Iran do you find people are surprised by when they read about it in your books or see it in your movies?
Well, it's very weird. You know, a couple of years ago, I was making, you know, like some lectures and, you know, book tours and all of that. And that was a very old lady who read one of my books. She came to me and she said, oh, you know, I'm not any more scared of the Iranian. And I was like, how come? And she said, because I didn't know that you were laughing. You had any sense of humor.
That you could laugh?
Yes. You know, they have made it that we are these people. I mean, when you talk about Iran, it's either veil or is beard or is nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
And that reduces to some kind of, you know, abstract notion. That means we stop being human beings. Mm-hmm. And if you're not a human being, then of course you don't laugh. And of course you don't fall in love. And of course you don't like to eat ice cream. You know, you're just some abstract notion, which is dangerous because from the second that people, they become abstract notion, then you can go and bomb them. They're not human right. beings anymore. So I don't try, you know, to change the world with my film. But if they can say this country that we are so scared of, in the same country, a man died because of a love of a woman, I think that I have done what I had to do. I don't want more than that.
We do have two questions that we ask everybody on this show.
Yes.
The first of them is, if we were to meet you at a dinner party, say, what question should we not ask you? What is the question you're sort of sick of answering?
What do you think about the nuclear weapon in Iran?
Yeah.
If I was an expert of nuclear, yeah, I think that nobody should have the nuclear weapon to start with. What do I know?
All right. Our second question is, tell us something we don't know. And this can be about yourself or...
That I'm a man. No, it's not true. I'm not a man. No, but if I have to say, if I didn't become what I became, I would have loved to work in a circus and throw knives.
That is, really?
Yeah.
Why specifically knife thrower? It doesn't surprise me that you'd want to work in a circus given your films. But
a knife thrower, I think, is the coolest thing in the world. You know, like they would put, you know, like a scarf on my eye and I will just throw knives here and there. I would have loved to do that. But, you know, unfortunately, I became an artist and I couldn't throw knives.
It's metaphorically, you can throw knives as an artist, maybe.
Yeah, OK, I will try.
Marjan Satrapi, her movie Chicken with Plums opens in L.A. this week and rolls into theaters around the country next month.
Enrico, I had no idea Iranian television aired Who's the Boss.
Yes, actually.
No wonder there's so much tension between the U.S. and Iran.
Actually, I think she might have seen it in France. That's more like...
Man, no wonder there's so much tension between us and France.
And now, time to eavesdrop.
Emma Straub dazzled readers last year with the short story collection Other People We Married. This week, she releases her highly anticipated debut novel. Today, we overhear her read an excerpt.
Hello, my name is Emma Straub, and my novel is Laura Lamont's Life in Pictures. It's the life story of a fictional movie star. So in this scene, Elsa and her husband, Gordon Pitts, who met at this regional theater in Wisconsin, have just moved to Hollywood in the late 1930s. This is their first big party thrown by Lewis Gardner, the head of the Gardner Brothers Studios. And Elsa is really pregnant. Elsa wanted to go home and take off her heels. Her already large feet had swelled up another whole size, and her toes were hanging out the peep toe, looking more monstrous than peep-worthy. She scuffed the bottom of her shoes on the concrete floor. "We have horses who do that on command," a small, thin man with glasses said. He stood to Elsa's right and held out a glass. "Cheers," he said, "to the baby." Elsa accepted the drink, which had a lime bobbing gamely near the top. "Thank you," Elsa said. "I'm Elsa Pitts." "Ah, the young, fertile wife of Mr. Gordon Pitts, I presume." "I'm sorry," she said. "Do I know you?" "Irving Green," he said. "I work here." It was only then that Elsa noticed the small audience surrounding them. A growing ring of actors and other hangers-on had positioned their bodies so that Mr. Green, should he wish, would be able to see them. Irving Green was second only to Lewis Gardner himself, and from what Elsa heard, maybe even more powerful. Elsa stood up straight and tried not to move. She felt embarrassed at her own ignorance, embarrassed that she had looked so out of place that he'd felt the need to speak to her. "Sir, it's a pleasure to meet you." She clutched her sweating glass with both hands. "Have you ever thought about acting?" Irving said, staring at her steadily through the tinted panes of his glasses. Elsa shifted on her heels. Off in the distance, she heard Gordon shouting into another man's ear. They were drunk already. Elsa said, "My parents have a small theater in Wisconsin. It's all I've ever known." She wanted to tell him about the first time she walked on a stage and how it meant that she could be anyone she wanted instead of just herself. Elsa answered his question. "I think about it all the time." Irving took in this information and nodded. "I bet you were the prettiest girl in town." Elsa laughed, but Irving stared at her so directly that Elsa began to color. She quieted down as quickly as possible. "I'm afraid not, Mr. Green, but thank you for the compliment." He nodded. "Here's what you should do. Do you mind if I tell you? Have the baby. take a few months, lose 30 pounds. Not so much that you lose the milkmaid look, though. It's your trademark, Miss Wisconsin, all sweetness and light. And Elsa Pitts isn't going to cut it, is it? Irving looked at her hard. Elsa blushed. Laura Lamont, he said. You want it? It's yours. Come see me when you're ready. What did he say? Gordon asked, nearly panting with excitement. He liked that last scene I did with the horse, didn't he? I knew he was going to like that. Elsa took a sip of her drink. Mr. Green? He was very nice, Elsa said. She sounded like her mother, as cool-tempered as if she'd been hypnotized. He gave me a new name. He did what? The pretend friendliness in his voice was gone. She wanted to remind Gordon that when they met, they were both actors in a play, and that she hadn't always been someone's mother. He told me to lose some weight. Oh, Gordon said, clearly relieved. He is tough. I told you that, didn't I? He's tough. The baby's really moving around, she said. I think I'd better go home.
Author Emma Straub reading from her debut novel, Laura Lamont's Life in Pictures. And you're listening to The Dinner Party from American Public Media.
And now it's time for the main course, the part of the show where we talk about food.
So, Rico, you've heard of pizza pies, pizza rolls,
yes.
Pizza parties.
Indeed.
But have you ever heard of the Pizza Museum?
I had an exhibit of pizza boxes in the kitchen of my college dorm. Does that count?
That's different. That's called Sloth.
Oh.
Different sort of museum.
I majored in
it. I'm talking about the world's largest collection of pizza memorabilia, according to the folks at Guinness.
All right.
It's housed in a new pizza shop called Pizza Brain that opens this weekend in my hometown of Philadelphia.
Best name ever.
Pretty good name. Earlier this week, I stopped by to get a sneak peek, and I spoke with two parts of that brain, Brian Dwyer and Ryan Anderson. They're two of the guys behind the project. And I asked Brian where he got the idea.
The seed of the idea started in May of 2010. I got a bunch of friends together, and we curated what we called, you know, Philadelphia's first pizza-centric art show. It was called Give Pizza a Chance. It was simple enough. It was, let's throw an art show that doesn't feel like an art show. That's a pizza party. And we'll get free pizza out, and we'll, you know, people from all walks of life can enjoy that. That night changed my life, because little did I know that about 300 people would show up from the neighborhood.
I mean, free pizza, people are going to show up.
Yeah, you say free pizza, people will take an art too. And so I woke up the next morning and I said, man, I would love to do that pizza art show again. What if it was a pizza shop that was self-aware enough to like actually celebrate the culture of pizza the way that art show felt?
Pizza Mecca.
Like a pizza Mecca, a pizza church.
You also have a ton of pizza memorabilia. How did you go about collecting it?
At the time, I had a lot of knickknacks that I have in my studio, pizza records, things like that. So I said, well, if we were to open this place, it would be like a pizza museum. So surely that exists. You know, that was just like a no-brainer. Someone has done this. I'll just kind of mimic that idea. Googled it, searched it. I found nothing. I found nobody that collected stuff. And I contacted Guinness. I type in pizza collection, nothing. And considering there are collections out there for Coca-Cola memorabilia, Santa Claus, bananas, it blew me away. It was a crime, you know, that it didn't exist yet.
And so, Ryan, what's your involvement in Pizza Brain?
I'm involved. I'm one of the four partners in the business, and I'm also designing and building out the space for the museum and the restaurant.
What kind of challenges present themselves when you're trying to incorporate a museum and a restaurant?
It's a challenge to try and figure out ways to display what we have so that it doesn't look like a Cracker Barrel or a Hard Rock Cafe, just like stuff stapled to the walls, you know, like kind of coming up with new ways to display the memorabilia is a big priority of mine.
What kind of items are part of the Pizza Museum?
It runs the entire gamut of objects out there. I mean, whether it's film, whether it's music, toys, kids' books, novels, like murder mysteries. Pizza has found its way into every nook and cranny of pop culture.
What are some of the sexiest kind of items?
Some of the sexiest items, for sure, are right behind me.
You mean sexy literally, because we're looking at a hot and saucy pizza poster.
Yeah, this is actually Hot and Saucy Pizza Girls. This is an adult film from the 70s starring John C. Holmes about a ragtag group of, you know, skateboarding delivery girls who do extra things for tips. I have the movie as well if you want to borrow it.
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, it's actually pretty gross. But this, you know, we have a wide selection of movie posters.
Yeah, here's another. Maybe is a little more appropriate for public radio here. Patrick Dempsey is lover boy. He delivers. Can you read that tagline?
There are a lot of hungry housewives in Beverly Hills. Some of them even like pizza.
Wow. Have you seen that film?
Of course. I have spent many, many hours kind of archiving footage, movies, TV shows, cartoons where there's pizza in it. And you're going to see that play out in the media corner.
Do you have a favorite piece of memorabilia, Ryan?
Yeah, it's probably the USS Enterprise pizza cutter. It's like a very realistic stainless steel pizza cutter shaped like the USS Enterprise. You hold, you know, whatever the engines in the back are, like the handle, and the disc in front is the blade.
I guess if you're a Star Trek geek and you do get out of your parents' basement, you will maybe get a job at a pizza place. No offense. Part of the collection features this beautiful wall of records about pizza. I had no idea there was so much music made about pizza. I like Pizza Hut hits. I had no idea that Pizza Hut was a band before it was a chain restaurant.
Well, that's the thing, actually. The biggest commonality on the wall is a lot of these records were put out by pizza shops in the 70s and 80s.
Season's Greetings, Domino's Pizza. I had no idea.
I would say there are two records that kind of started it all for me. When I was on a honeymoon with my wife,
Glad you invited her to join you.
Yes. When we were at a pizza shop in San Francisco, and I saw this tiny little case with three records in it, and that really was the first time where I said, like, really, records about pizza? So the three records that were in that case that I immediately went home and found on eBay was Music to Eat Pizza By, presented by Gino's Pizza, featuring the Duluth Accordionaires. It's a 27-piece accordion band. The next was Pizzas and Bongos by the Irving Fields Trio. And then, of course, Fat Boys.
Amazing.
This one is a real mind fudge. You know, it's like you've got the Fat Boys surrounding themselves on a pizza, miniature versions of themselves in burglar outfits eating pizza.
All right, so what's your favorite pizza memorabilia?
Well, I will say this much. My favorite does not exist in the collection yet. I am hoping someone out there will hear this cry and they will help me out. On my wish list, my Great White Buffalo is a piece of Pizza the Hut. From the set, you know, from Spaceballs. I feel like somewhere in a storage garage in Hollywood or somewhere rotting in Illinois is this sculpture, this suit. Let it be known, if anybody knows the whereabouts of any part of Pizza the Hut, I want a piece of it. I want it in a case in our museum. It belongs here.
Pizza, pizza.
So, Rico, another piece in the exhibit is Brian's tattoo.
Okay.
It's an illustration of Brian holding a slice of pizza. And underneath it, it says, totally sawsome. So that's obviously part of the permanent collection.
Yay. All right, coming up, ladies and gentlemen, we get a tutorial on another of life's essentials, air. The author of a new book on that invisible gaseous substance will be here. Also, the band Nude Beach suggests a dinner party soundtrack. And acerbic satirist Fran Lebowitz answers your etiquette questions.
Be sort of afraid when the dinner party continues. Welcome back to The Dinner Party, the show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I am Brendan Francis Newnham.
I'm Rico Galliano. In a few minutes, we visit Nude Beach. They're a band, not a lifestyle, by the way.
Although, since this is radio, we could be broadcasting from a nude beach, and you wouldn't be the wiser.
That's true, but we would be colder, and I think headphones would be against the dress code, right?
That's a good point.
Yes.
So, speaking of bad ideas, it's time for our weekly etiquette lesson.
Yes, each week you send us your questions about how to behave, and here to answer them this week is Fran Lebowitz. In the early 70s, at the age of 21, I believe, she wrote a column for Andy Warhol's fledgling magazine Interview. Those pieces were later collected in the books Metropolitan Life and Social Studies. Since then, she has also acted on TV shows like Law and Order and was the subject of Martin Scorsese's 2010 documentary Public Speaking. This week, she releases the first ever audiobook of her early essays called The Fran Lebowitz Reader. And Fran, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
And that's it. Interview's over.
Yeah, thanks for coming by.
I found a piece about you in a Paris Review from about 20 years back in which George Plimpton said of your writing, quote, "She disapproves of virtually everything except sleep, cigarette smoking, and good furniture."
That's true.
Is that overstatement at all?
It's an understatement.
Well, where did that attitude come from?
I don't know. Birth. I had it since birth. I've been exactly the same since I was born, except I used to be a little shorter.
Did you smoke as a baby?
Well, my mother did. Okay, so I suppose, yeah.
So in a way.
All right, well, wherever it came from, in the 70s and 80s, you apparently trained a lot of your ire on New York City. A lot of these essays are about New York. If you were to write these pieces today, would they be at all different? Because I listened to one entitled Diary of a New York Apartment Hunter, and it might as well have been written yesterday.
That's largely true of the pieces, and that's partially because I was a prophet and partially because, of course, things change less than you imagine.
Well, but in the Scorsese documentary, you actually say that New York has changed a lot, that it's basically all rich people now.
Well, it's made it worse. There were, of course, always rich people in New York, but there were two things that were different. There were other people than the rich people, and this was especially true of kids. In other words, we are getting a horrible quality kid in New York because they are the children of people who are rich. There's just an incredible brat factor, you know, and to me, that's really one of the worst things. You know,
but New York loves you. I mean, you're kind of an icon of the city. How does that jive with this new entitled group of people living here? Because you're not very kind to them. I mean,
they love you despite your, yes. your scorn.
Or because.
Because they know you're right.
Because it's something new. It's exotic to them.
To be scorned?
Yes. Because they've had just nothing bad has ever happened to them.
So they can accept a little bit from you. It's kind of like going to a dominatrix or something like that.
Yeah, what do you mean kind of?
Well, maybe you can train some of your scorn on our listeners.
Delighted.
Great. They have some etiquette questions for you. Here we go. Kate in Mount Desert Island, Maine, writes, in this age of gluten-free and locavore, how much menu customizing is a dinner host/hostess supposed to do for a guest?
Zero. Zero. Now, I have to say that I am a guest. You know, the world is divided between guests and hosts, I'm a guest. Uh-huh. But sometimes people call to invite you to dinner and say, do you have any dietary requirements?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no. I mean,
Okay,
if they serve something that you can't eat, eat when you get home. It's not a matter of nutrition, a dinner party. It's called a dinner party. So no, you can't ask them to make special food for you. They shouldn't ask you.
Put the emphasis on the party part of the dinner party.
Yes, that's the point.
Although I do have to say that it may be easy for you to say that, you know, food is not the most important thing, because when we were talking to you before we started taping, it sounded like you pretty much subsist on cigarettes and coffee.
No, no, I love to eat.
Accurate?
I love to eat. I just feel that when I go to someone else's house, that is their house, whatever they prepare, that's what I'll eat.
You shouldn't make demands of them, but on the other hand, they shouldn't be offended if you don't eat something. Because I think that could be Kitty's concern, right?
Well, they shouldn't be looking at your plate, okay? You should be actually more interesting than that. If they're looking at your plate, you're dull.
You're doing it wrong.
Yes.
All right. There you go. We have another question from Stephanie in Tucson, Arizona. She asks, what is the proper etiquette for handling myself when I'm surrounded by friends singing happy birthday? Do I bashfully laugh? Do I make eye contact with people individually? It's not really a tune I can dance to.
Well, I don't know her, but here's what I'm guessing. This comes up only once a year. So I'm trying to imagine a life so free of problems that you could concentrate on this. So I would say if people are singing happy birthday to you, smile.
Yeah.
Say thank you.
Yeah.
That's it.
But all right.
Okay, let me give you an example, though. What if you're at a restaurant? Because this is, I think, the hardest thing to deal with. And somebody else has arranged for, say, the waiters to stand around and sing happy birthday to you. One of the most embarrassing sort of situations in modern life. What do? Do you look at the waiters? Do you clap along? Even you didn't ask for it. You didn't expect it.
Well, if someone did this to me, that would be the last time I saw them. Okay, so my suggestion would be, do not go to a restaurant on your birthday. That's what dinner parties are for.
Yeah.
That is a deplorable situation. I agree.
I like, Fran, that you just recommended that someone smile. I don't think people would think that would be a suggestion from you.
I recommended other people smile.
She says unsmilingly.
Samantha in Edmonton, Canada, a place where I think people smile rather often. She writes the following. I have spent the better part of my adulthood living alone. As someone who has studied visual culture and art history, I have a keen eye for interior design. Recently, I moved into a phenomenal home with roommates. How can I assert my distaste for some of the so-called artworks in this home that I moved into?
Well, first of all, I have lived alone since I was 18.
Uh-huh.
And it's not by accident. Okay? So although she may feel she has this very high aesthetic, the fact that she would agree to have her house cluttered up with other people, you know.
You're saying the people to begin with, like, forget the art.
Yes, the people, yes. The worst thing you can have in your house is other people. She should move out.
Hence why you are not a host, you are a guest.
It's a variation on Camus. Samantha would say hell is other people's art, and you're just saying hell is other people.
That is correct.
So. Yeah.
All right, well, actually, this may apply to the last question, which is what's the most memorable get-together you've ever been to? Who, what, where? Details, please.
We asked this of all of our etiquette guests.
Well, this is what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Right? When Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize, she took a bunch of her friends, including me, to Stockholm with her. At the Nobel Prize ball, there was a big seating plan outside and everything leather-bound, very beautiful. Toni was sitting with the king at the king's table, and the rest of her friends were all sitting together. Everyone was sitting together except me. I was at another table, which was entirely occupied by Swedish aristocrats. And they were so not happy to have me at this table, I can't tell you. They, you know, they didn't know me, but they could tell right at a glance I wasn't a Swedish aristocrat.
Really?
There was a mistake. So I was then taken to another table, which turned out to be the children's table at the Nobel Prize ball. By which I mean, the next oldest person to me at this table was 12. The Nobel Prize ball dinner is 4.5 hours long. There was a little boy, and I mean little, like an 8-year-old boy sitting next to me. It's white tie, the Nobel Prize ball. And so this kid had this rented outfit on, you know, and he kept saying, I'm strangling, I'm strangling, I'm dying. I don't think he'd ever had a shirt with buttons on before. That was the most memorable evening of my life.
You got the Nobel Prize for...
for patience.
Yes. All right, Fran Lebowitz, her new audiobook is called The Fran Lebowitz Reader. Thank you so much for telling our audience how to behave like grown-ups.
You're welcome.
Now, it's time for Chattering Class. This is the part of the show where we are schooled in a dinner party-worthy topic. This week, the topic is air, and our teacher is William Bryant Logan. He is a Quill and Trowel Award-winning writer, a member of the faculty at the New York Botanical Garden, and the author of the books Oak and Dirt. He has a new book out called Air, The Restless Shaper of the World. So, Bill, my first question is simply, what is air?
I think probably the simplest explanation is it's what we breathe in and what all creatures breathe in and breathe out. So it both contains the materials we need in order to metabolize and remain alive, but it also contains a whole lot of other things that it transports around the world, where they do things like decay everything that dies. If it wasn't for the air transporting fungi and bacteria, for example, we would be more than waist deep in dead things.
It's nice of air to eliminate those things for us. But the real rock star component of air is oxygen. That's what everyone thinks of when they think of air.
Yeah, and it's very important in a lot of ways. Of course, most of us are air breathers, though, you know, the oldest creatures on Earth could not breathe oxygen. And in fact, when oxygen began to be abundant, they all had to hide, find somewhere else to live, or they would die, because to them it was a pollutant. Huh.
You know, your book is filled with lots of neat facts like that. What surprised you the most about air when you started to research it?
Oh, my goodness. So much is surprising about it. One of the things that was most surprising was how many living things are transported through it invisibly. We are breathing in a considerable number of the spores and the actual organisms of living things. When you can collect them out of the air, which I've learned how to do, it's amazing. It's better than fishing to be able to, like, plate them on a slide, look at what you just collected out of the air you're breathing, and see all of these beautiful, strangely shaped creatures in it. So that was one thing that just shocked and delighted me.
See, I don't think I want to know what's in the air I'm breathing. That's probably because I'm always reading about air pollution. How is the air we're breathing these days?
Well, it's very interesting. We're kind of between a rock and a hard place, because certainly the pollutants themselves were worse up until about the 1970s, when people, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, right after the war, there were all over the world these strange things, like there was a killer, it was called the Big Smoke in London in the 50s, I think 52, when on a winter's day they had such bad smog, not only did several thousand people die of it, but they had a performance of La Traviata that had to be canceled because you couldn't see the stage. And people began to say, hey, this is no good. We have to get rid of this. So certainly in most of the so-called developed world, we have cleaned up the kinds of materials we emit, although we still emit a huge number compared to what happened before the industrial era. So we emit a lot less, and we have a lot less pollutants. On the other hand, because we still burn so much, we're putting so much carbon into the atmosphere that we're significantly changing the climate. And the interesting thing is that one of the reasons we maybe didn't notice the global climate change for so long was the number of pollutants we had in the air up until the Clean Air Acts of the 70s, because pollutants tend to lower temperature, tend to cause climatic cooling, whereas carbon tends to cause climatic warming. So in a sense, all the pollutants we were making, although they were bad for us in themselves, were damping global warming.
That is a sad irony. This book goes into detail not only about the history of air and the science of air, but also talks about how artists have portrayed and discussed air. Is there one artist in particular who gave you an interesting insight into air?
Oh, my. Well, a painter, El Greco, because I studied a lot of the history of Western thinking about clouds in the air. And indeed, for most of Western history, clouds in the air were regarded as where demons lived. They were a horrible place, and you wanted to avoid them. So it's very hard to find any clouds at all in a medieval painting. Usually they'll use gold leaf or something.
That's fascinating.
But when you get to El Greco, not only does he love clouds and make them the foundation of heaven, but all of his people, the more lively they are, the more they look like flames, the more they're like climbing into the sky. It's just beautiful.
So while writing this book, you surely must have attended some dinner parties. What's the one fact about air that you would use to wow the other guests?
Well, something directly related to dinner. There are lots of aerosols in the air, right? They're probably, if you pretended you were holding a basketball in New York City, held it out in front of you, and the volume of air held between your two hands, there are probably about, I don't know, 175,000, 250,000 aerosols, that is invisible particles in the air.
Yeah.
The most common of those aerosols in New York City is fat.
Really?
Yeah, and it's very probably from a combination of restaurant chimneys and food carts and food trucks and everything else that's producing foods in New York. In fact, when I collected samples out on the Brooklyn Bridge, I caught a number of blobs of fat.
It's a little frightening, but I'm also kind of proud of New York for that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of nice to be able to like have enough restaurants that you're actually contributing to the air. Though I talked to a young woman about this who said, "My God, does it make me fat?" No, I don't think so.
No, but it makes New York delicious.
Yes, exactly.
See, Brendan, this is why New York real estate is so expensive.
Okay.
Air fat. It's like inhaling a free meal.
That's right.
It's very valuable.
That's right. You combine it with air sugar and your respiratory system becomes a donut machine.
Yes. Lung donuts. I cannot wait.
Oh.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have met our guest of honor. We've learned some good manners. That would be good in quotes, by the way.
Yeah.
All that's left is to play some music. Here to help are Rock and Rollers' Nude Beach. Their latest album, Nude Beach 2, has been the soundtrack to many a rooftop BBQ this summer. Here's what they've been playing at their gatherings.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Chuck.
We're two of three members of the Brooklyn band Nude Beach.
And here's our dinner party soundtrack.
My first choice is some music that I actually played when I had some friends over for dinner the other night. It was the Go-Betweens, the song called Spring Rain. I'm like all obsessed with them right now. The Go-Betweens are a band from Australia. This is off the Liberty Bell record and it came out in the 80s. And yeah, it's just a really nice, awesome, jangly pop song with an awesome chorus. It's fun to listen to.
So the next song is The Move, a song called Useless Information, which is a really cool, weird song. Sister Jane has a little book full of all to love, so useless people. They're like late 60s, kind of like psych pop British stuff. That's really cool. Pretty like Beatles influenced. Hundreds of people left out to go. Jeff Lynne was later in the band The Move, Jeff Lynne being famous for ELO. Before he was in the band, The Move recorded this record, but they were a huge British sensation. Tons of useless information seems to fill my head. You know where else to go. The production's pretty busted. You know, it's pretty lo-fi considering the time period, I guess, but I like that.
My next pick is also from 1968. It's this weird garage band called The Box, B-A-C-H-S, and they put an album out that was called Out of the Box. The Box were from Chicago, and the song is called Tables of Grass Fields.
Apparently, they were only like 16 or 17 when they recorded this record. When I see you, I get a feeling that is hard to explain, and every time it happens, I feel the same.
They're like one of the most obscure, I guess, garage bands of that era. They put this record out and there's 100 copies of it or something, 150 copies. But what's interesting about the album is that it's mostly original songs, And a lot of garage bands back then just did covers of rock and roll standards and stuff like that. Why don't you come down from living above? I don't know that I was introduced to the Box at a dinner party, but it was a similar scenario when I was just sitting around with some friends listening to music and
sitting around a table of grass field.
Yeah, and this record kind of like blew me away.
If we had to pick one of our own songs from our new record to play at the dinner party, I guess it would be The Endless Night. Not quite about eating or drinking or anything like that per se, but talks about the nighttime, I suppose.
And all of our songs are kind of about drinking, right?
Sure.
Dinner Party soundtrack from Ryan Nadeau and Chuck Betts from the band Nude Beach. Their new album Nude Beach 2 came out on the Other Music label earlier this month. And that's the Dinner Party for this week, folks.
Yes, till next week, you can keep up with us on Facebook or on Twitter. Our handle is Dinner Party DNLD.
Jackson Musker is assistant producer of the Dinner Party. Tamika Adams and James Kim are our Uber interns. Thanks also to Ravi Carmen, Peter Clowney, and our friends at the public radio show Marketplace.
Bon appétit.